Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. And today, you know, we're going to be zeroing in a bit on seeds. It's amazing to me. I bet it is to you, too, if you stop to think about it. You've got this little seed in your hand and how it can grow into a wonderful plant with fruit or vegetables for you and for me to eat. It's just an amazing thing as far as I'm concerned. Our two guests today have spent a lot of time working with seeds, and we're going to be talking with them about what they do and about seeds and how you can get involved too. Julie Dawson and Nicholas Angelbear. Julie is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She leads the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative in Wisconsin. And Julie, great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Nico Angelbear, plant breeder by training, CEO and co-founder of something called Seed Link. And Nico, thank you for being with us as well.
Hey, Larry. Thanks so much for having us.
So they have a pretty neat project they're working on, and you can help them with it. They'll tell us about it, and of course, they'll answer your vegetable seed questions. So I hope you'll join in today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Julie, let's start out with the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative. That's what something you're leading, and you're in the Department of
Horticulture.
Horticulture at UW-Madison, and this is part of that department.
Yes. So I started at UW about 5 years ago, a little more than that now, and my position with the department and with Extension is to work a lot with farmers who are selling to farmers markets or through CSAs, and directly to consumers. And one of the main traits that they look for in vegetables is flavor and quality. And we started out talking to farmers, and I went to a conference in New York City with Erwin Goldman, who's the chair of our department, that was hosted by a chef there who was interested in bringing plant breeders and chefs together to breed for flavor. That was Dan Barber, who's a chef in New York City. And there we met Tori Miller, who's a chef here in Madison. And we said Madison would be a great place to do a project that is trying to develop vegetable varieties that are adapted to northern climates and have really great flavor. And we got a group of chefs together, a group of farmers together, and started brainstorming about how we could do that. And what it's evolved into is a trialing network with the participation of a lot of plant breeders across the country that are interested in developing varieties for flavor and for adaptation to more northern climates, to smaller scale diversified farms and gardens. Farms and gardens throughout Wisconsin can trial varieties with us, and then we have a couple of research stations where we do larger scale trials of a lot of varieties. And then we work with a group of chefs, and every month they test a different set of varieties for us, and they give us feedback on the quality, how they work in the kitchen, what the flavor is like, and what they're looking for. And so we have a really dedicated group of farm-to-table chefs in Madison that has made this project really work.
Yeah. Do you get to go and sample what they cook or prepare?
Yes, so we do, yeah, that's one of the perks. We have it at a different restaurant every month, and it's in the morning usually when the restaurant isn't open. And so we test the varieties, and then every year we have a dinner at the end of the season where we feature some of the best varieties, and every chef will make a small dish with their favorite variety. It ranges. There are some varieties that are bred here at UW-Madison. There are some that are bred by smaller seed companies in different parts of the U.S. or different universities. And they feature that variety, and we tell the public the story of that variety, and everyone can sample it. And that's called the Farm to Flavor Dinner. And it's usually in August or September, kind of towards the end of the
season. Yeah, right, harvest time.
Yeah. So that's always available on our website if people want to get more information and come taste some of these varieties.
So what does this mean for consumers or the average gardener?
So we're hoping that what the end result is more varieties that are really excellent flavor and very productive in Wisconsin environments. We're giving breeders information on how these varieties perform for flavor, for yield, for disease resistance, for earliness. And those decisions then can be informed by Wisconsin environments. So when they put it into their catalog, a seed company will know, does this variety grow well in Wisconsin? And hopefully they can make recommendations then to growers about which ones they should grow.
So, Nico, how does SeedLink fit into this?
Yeah, that's thanks, Julie. It was an amazing introduction. And first, I would like to thank Julie for letting me jump in this, all this wonderful project. And as your description of Julie, you can see already that you have a lot of data flowing, a lot of information from chef, from gardener, from breeder, from farmer, and how to gather this information in a very intuitive and fluid way and make very good information for all of you who are listening to what to plant where you are. Like 2 weeks for 2 weeks ago, we were, for example, evaluating potato fry with four or five chefs. And so we all gather information on the flavor and what's really tasting really well. Well, SeedLinked is a platform that allow all this information to flow very frictionless in a platform. And on both ends, let's say you as a gardener, you want to look for a really nice carrot or a squash or a tomato. You can, in the future, go in SeedLinked and look at all this data that's going to be gathered for you, for your environment, and you can really make a decision and see the full story of all those variety. It's also allowed Julie and all the network to gather the information instead of pen and paper, and with all the friction and trouble that can be associated by collecting all this data, we can just have an app and data directly sent to a platform. All this data is interactive. People can see, the farmer can see it. So all those amazing independent breeders that really do amazing work all across the country, they really need this information to develop new adapted variety. This information, this data is really the core engine in a breeding program and how we breed. And so we really help both ends. And so this platform is not a new idea, but I've been a breeder for about 8 years, and I really all the time been fascinated by participatory breeding. And I run into Julie in different conference, and here we are. I resign one of my job and jump full on.
So this is SeedLink is a company then?
It is a company. Right now it's LLC, it's a startup. It has just 1 year old. And thanks to USDA, we got a really nice grant. They have SBIR grant. It's a startup grant. And with Julie together, we applied, and we are really honored and thankful to USDA to award us for a grant for 18 months. We're going to prove the concept of being of this platform we call crowdsourcing. So how can we get information from farmer and gardener in a very intuitive way, and then allow breeder and other, or the whole network, to make better decision.
I think one of the reasons why having a phone application or an online application for some of the data management is interesting is because the bottleneck with our system right now is that all of the information comes through my group. So we're very good at summarizing the research station data. We get that data in, we can get it out to breeders, and the breeders want to go through all of the individual crops and varieties. A lot of farmers and gardeners want more of a summary, and right now we need to get all of the information back from farmers and gardeners about how those varieties did, summarize it, and then send it back out, which involves some delay. And usually we don't have a lot of time between when we get them back and when people want to buy seed. And so we would like to have a platform where, as people rate varieties, so we send out, say, a trial of pepper varieties, we'll send out five varieties. People plant them under their normal conditions. The farmers would put them in their normal production and market. Gardeners would produce them, eat them, and then tell us, would you grow this again? How well did it sell? What was the flavor like? What was the production like? It's all qualitative information, but then when we have enough people, we really get a good sense of how the variety is doing across Wisconsin. But we have to bring that all in, summarize it, and send it back out. With an online platform, people could see other people's responses in real time, and we would no longer be the bottleneck for getting that information out to growers. And the seed companies could also then see how farmers were rating them and how gardeners were rating them across a lot of the Midwest.
Yeah, I would think that, you know, if you're somebody who's producing the seeds, you'd want to kind of look and see, well, what do the gardeners think of the flavor of this particular variety, or how well did they like it, Nico?
Yeah, I mean, as a breeder, and I've been a breeder for 8 years, that's the holy grail. It's the dream of a breeder is getting feedback for all your customer or your end user, and really this idea germinated, you know, this seed of platform germinated a long time ago, 7 years ago. And it's so nice to see it now coming together. And I have a question for you, Larry, or maybe for the listener, that kind of reinforce the point. Yesterday, I was just glancing to see how many tomato variety I could buy online to see the choice. And Larry, what's a guess of how many do you think, how many tomato variety I could find out there?
Oh, 4,000 or 5,000? A lot.
You're right there. Yeah, congratulations. How do you make a decision? Like, it can be a daunting task, especially imagine for a farmer. As a gardener, you don't have too much economic impact on choosing a new variety that you would like to explore. But a farmer, you need choosing the seed is one of the most important decisions you make early on, and picking the right seed for your place can really make your old farm much more economically resilient. And so
I was just thinking about myself, because I usually, you know, as a gardener, I will have a couple of old standbys that I know are going to produce well, and then I'll usually pick one or two. Maybe it's one that or two that somebody on the show here recommended, or I look at the seed pack. Oh, that really looks good. And not knowing a thing about what, well, I assume that it's a big, you know, our one of the good things is our the people who sell our garden store folks, especially the local ones, really know what works and what doesn't, Julie.
Yeah, I think so. We did a kind of informal survey of farmers, and most people get information from neighbors, from other farmers that are their peers, from seed company representatives that they trust that are Midwest representatives. So very similarly to gardeners who might talk to their neighbors or to the seed dealer at wherever they're getting their seeds. I think that is a good way of getting recommendations. It's not as comprehensive as it could be. So if you have two neighbors, you can ask two people. If you have a network of people that are doing trialing, you all of a sudden have access to a lot more people's opinions that may be in your same climate. And we did a survey to see what information people wanted about the varieties before they decided to grow them. And flavor was the most important one.
I bet.
Yeah, and then disease resistance and yield. So productivity traits, this is more direct market growers, and then earliness, which is fairly obvious for northern climates. So we are trying to produce that information on a lot of varieties on the research station and then send out a curated set of the ones that we think are the most worth a look in these on-farm trials. So we might have 30 to 60 varieties per crop on the research station. After a year, we kind of know which ones look the best. Obviously, we keep them in more than 1 year, but we'll send out the most promising ones to on-farm trials, and then we want people's feedback about how they actually did, because that's the reality check. It might do well on the research station, and we try to make the research station as representative as possible of what farmers are doing, but it's only one site. We do have a site in northern Wisconsin now in Spooner, so that's helped a lot. But those two locations can't necessarily be representative of all of Wisconsin.
No, it's not like the Superior or Madison is not like a Marshfield area.
Exactly, right.
So for example, yeah, so this year we're going to have, as an example, three trials. We're going to have six cucumber, we're going to have six carrots and six pepper. We're going to test with the platform, and we're going to have 100 of gardener testing three variety and sending feedback. And actually we're still looking for a few gardeners that if any of you listening who want to be part of it, you're more than welcome to sign up on the platform. But all this information then going to be gathered and going to be useful for all of you who are listening, because you're going to be able to see.
You should probably say that it's free to access the platform.
Yeah, everything is free, and it's welcome for everyone. Yeah.
So as you're listening to these two experts talk, maybe you have an idea you might like to get involved in something like this. We're talking today with Julie Dawson, assistant professor in the Department of Horticulture. She leads the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative in Wisconsin. We've been talking about Nicholas Angelbear is the co-founder and CEO of his group. It's called Seed Link, all one word. He has expertise in a lot of areas, data architecture, crop modeling, fundamental breeding techniques, participatory breeding strategies. And they're certainly ready and willing to answer your questions. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, and the email address is ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, for the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. We're taking a look at seeds today. It starts with seeds, you know, and Julie Dawson of the UW Department of Horticulture leads the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative in Wisconsin. Nico Angelbear, a co-founder and CEO of his company called SeedLink, and they're with us to talk about what they're doing to help you and me and every gardener out there get better tasting, or come up with seeds that wind up producing a better tasting crop, maybe more of a particular crop in terms of production. I had pretty good luck this year with most of my tomatoes. I had one variety that didn't produce worth a darn, to be perfectly honest.
You had better luck than we did. Ours were all saturated.
Last year was a tough year.
Well, yeah. See, I grew mine in bales of straw, so
that probably helped.
I think that helped. But I'll tell you what, we will take your questions right now at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Mary in Milwaukee. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Three quick questions. You're not talking anything about nutrition. You're not talking anything about controlling of GMOs. And the public is funding private research. Does anything go back to the taxpayer?
All right. Great, great questions. Let's, Julie, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Yeah. So all of our crops, or all of our trials on the research station, are certified organic. So we do not use any GMOs. We get all of the varieties through traditional breeding, so crossing and then selection in the field, and we work with breeders who do that. A lot of the breeders are either from smaller seed companies or independent breeders or at universities. And so those varieties are generally made through just crossing the best two parents you have and then selecting from there. In terms of nutrition, I think that's an interesting question. The need for better nutrition is there. I think that by increasing the flavor and improving the flavor of vegetables, if people eat more, they will be better nourished. I do think we can increase the levels of certain nutrients in our crops, and we need to work on that. But we've been focusing more on flavor, because increasing the quantity of vegetables, I think, is the key way we can improve nutrition. We do look at pigmentation, which are usually orange and red and purple pigments are derived from antioxidants, so carotenoids in carrots, lycopene in tomatoes, anthocyanins in some of the purple pigments that you see. Those are all beneficial compounds, and so by selecting for higher pigmentation and for brighter colors, we're also selecting for better nutrition. And then in terms of the public funding private research, the grants from the USDA is specifically for small business innovation research and requires a partnership between a university and a company. So that is a criteria of the grant. There's not any UW-Madison money going to support SeedLinks. It's a partnership between my research program, which is primarily grant-funded, and then SeedLinks is the platform that people have it's being developed so that people can have easier access to the data. There's no charge for that to the public. So they can access all the data free of charge. The grant is funding the programming and all of the back end of it, which is actually quite expensive and difficult to do without some kind of grant funding. And Nicola can talk a little bit more about the future of SeedLinked and what he's planning for that.
Yeah, no, it's a really great question. And I just want you all to understand, yeah, the core fundamental value of SeedLink is really transparency and ethics and open source of the data. And it's really to boost all those small, independent, little breeder, like Julie said. And so, we are really supporting this emerging organic and sustainable agriculture in a transparent and ethic way. And SeedLinks is a social enterprise. Really we are bringing a lot of information for everyone to be able to make better decisions, from the gardener, the farmer, to the small independent breeder, as you know, in this very consolidated and globalized economy. And so I strongly believe it's adding a lot of value to everyone. It's a collaborative effort as well. SeedLinks is not controlled just by myself. We are all working together to make this platform working well.
So. Yeah. Mary, does that help out?
Mary, may I add one more thing, and I'm sorry to interrupt you. Your answers have belied some of my concerns, and I appreciate that. One quick thing, kidney failure in the family. It would be wonderful if fruits and vegetables on the market indicated safety for people in renal failure, because that is a real challenge in knowing what fruit and what vegetables to have. Usually it's a half a cup portion, but some are no-nos and others are yes. Mm-hmm. So that's something that the general market maybe could address and help people who like are diabetic and also people in renal failure, because it really is a challenge.
You know what, Mary, Nico's right, making a note right now about that very thing. Julia, comment on that?
I don't have any medical expertise, so I can't comment on which ones would be good or bad for that. I think you could probably find some information about which variety or which vegetables as a whole are acceptable, but I don't have medical expertise.
No, but I think she's the broader question she was asking, is there a place where wouldn't it be great if you had maybe a little section on the site that says medical issues and vegetables or something like that, and you could look and say people in renal failure, generally speaking, should not eat these vegetables, or they should eat these vegetables.
That's a terrific, it's really a great comment and idea. It's why we're here. We're getting feedback. it's working. Thanks so much.
I think we would need to get some input from the medical school before doing that. But
Yeah, for sure. Mary, thanks again. Appreciate the call. Well, let's go to next to Jill in Racine. She has a different kind of question from what Mary had. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I'd like to know a good seed to grow butternut squash and how to grow it. Before, I've grown it over like some hay, and then I grew it in a cage for a tomato plant, and I'd like to start them now if I could.
So you probably want to wait before starting them, because cucurbits are really frost sensitive, so you shouldn't plant them out until the danger of frost has passed, and you probably only want them 4 to 6 weeks ahead of time to start them, because for cucurbits, the thing you have to remember when you're transplanting them out is that their roots are very sensitive to transplants. So you want to start them in a big pot, at least a 4-inch pot probably, and not let them become root bound. And you'll have more success with transplanting them out. And you really need to wait until it's not going to freeze, because they're very frost sensitive. So I wouldn't start them now. I would wait until probably end of April or beginning of May.
See, Jill's in Racine, so she's in southern Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, you need to look at what your frost dates are. That's kind of what we do for Madison, so you may be a little farther south than we are. In terms of varieties, are you looking for kind of a small, single or two people size squash, or are you looking for a standard butternut?
A single.
So for small ones, ones we've had in our trials that have done well, one is called Butter Baby. It's a new one from Ball. That one's been really excellent in our taste tests and also productive. It started actually as a numbered line that we got under, you know, some string of letters and numbers that no one could remember because they were still making a decision on it, whether they were commercializing it, seed production, and all of that. And so now it has a name. It's called Butter Baby. That one is a good one. Another one that we've had is Brulee. That one's available from High Mowing Seed, I believe.
And how's it that was spelled?
High Mowing Organic Seed?
No,
oh, Brulee. It's B-R-U-L-E, accent on the U, and then E. So an accent on the E.
Another French word. I love this one. This is my favorite.
Yeah, right. I was going to say.
So like creme brulee? Yes,
yeah, okay.
Exactly.
That's where
it comes from.
I had a lot of those last year.
Right? Yeah. It's got a high sugar content, as you can imagine. And so that one also did well for the smaller size squash. That one was bred in between, it was a partnership between Cornell University, Michael Mazurek there, and High Mowing Organic Seed. Jody Lou Smith is the breeder there. And so those are the two I would recommend as smaller squash. There's also one that's a smaller size, but it's not a standard butternut shape. It's a butternut species. So butternut is Cucurbita machata. And it's the same species, but it's a rounder shape, and it's got ribs on it, more like an acorn squash, although the shape is a little different. It's a little narrower at the top and wider at the bottom. And that one's called Autumn Frost. It is an excellent storage squash. This year we had a major issue with our storage because we were bringing squash out of the field when it was really wet, and most of them have not stored well, and that one has maintained really good fruit in storage, and it's productive. So that one is also from Ball.
And Jill was wondering about, you know, when she gets those seeds out into the, you know, this, whenever, when did you say, what's a typically southern Wisconsin planting date?
Beginning of June for transplants.
Right around June for transplants.
Yeah.
What would you, she has a question about what to do with the planting.
So there are a couple of different ways that we have grown them. One is to grow them kind of in a mound system where you would have a raised mound, and you can put a few different plants in the top, and then each one will go down a different side. That's kind of, if you have an area in your garden and you want to kind of have a slightly raised mound with the butternut coming off of it.
How big a mound here are we talking? You know, is it 4 feet across or?
Yeah, probably.
About four feet.
And then you can
across?
Mulch it with straw around. That helps warm up the soil because it's slightly raised. So you'll get probably better growth and drainage because you'll have warmer and drier soil. A different way to do it that we've done is to essentially make raised beds, but just a little bit, not like
4 inches or something?
Yeah, something like that. Just with the soil, you don't need to make any structure or anything. And then you plant each one. I believe we put them several feet apart. So each squash will have
room to grow.
Yeah. Yes, they need quite a bit of room to grow. And then we'll put a mulch down on the raised bed. We've used landscape fabric as mulch, so putting down landscape fabric, burning a hole where you put the squash with propane or something, a little burner, or cutting it with a knife and then putting the squash right in there. That helps with weed control. We've also used straw mulch. The thing to remember with straw mulch is that it will keep the soil cooler and wetter. And so sometimes you want to not mulch until after the soil has warmed up a little bit, and try to get in there before the weeds get out of control. The landscape fabric doesn't have that problem, but it does have some issues where the squash may not be able to send down those adventitious roots as it vines. Mm-hmm. And so you won't have quite as much access to water later on because it won't have those roots later out in the periphery.
Gotcha. Jill, does that help?
Everything down. Plus, I'm raising mealworms. My neighbor got me to grow mealworms, too, for the bluebirds.
Oh!
That's great.
Well, I wouldn't put them in with the... You're not going to put them in with a butternut squash, are you?
No, but I think I got everything down.
All right. Well, that's good. Thank you, Jill. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. You two aren't mealworm experts, are you?
No. not that I know.
All right. Well, with that, we'll move to Jim in Denmark. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
What's on your mind today?
Oh, we're trying to grow as many potatoes, squash, and pumpkins as for the winter as we can. And we're interested in the storability of the vegetables which come from the seed. And so it seems that sweetness is the opposite of how storable it is, because the sweeter a vegetable, it seems, the quicker it rots. And we found that, for example, with the corded pumpkins that have really thick, sweet meat, and they're advertised for pies, and they rot very easy when we bring them into the farmhouse. So does your index cover storability? To us, it's more important than sweetness, because actually we're gonna add sugar when we make a pie. It really doesn't matter how sweet the vegetable is, but we want it not to rot and to be storable.
Yes, so we do take data on squash, onions, carrots, and potatoes in storage and how long they store over the course of several months. So we'll have a storage rating at 1 month, at 2 months, at 3 months. And that data is available on our website. It's seed2kitchen, all one word, .horticulture.wisc.edu. You can go to trial results. You would scroll all the way down to the bottom and click on the individual year trial results, and then that data is in there. It's not in the general summaries, although we're beginning to get enough data on storability that we're going to be putting in the storage ratings in the coming year. I think for the squash in particular, there is some relationship between sugar and storage. There's also a large effect of the species of squash on how long it can store. So Cucurbita pipo, which is what most pumpkins are, and summer squash and delicata type squash, acorn squash, those are all Cucurbita pipo. Those have the shortest shelf life of the squash species. Cucurbita maxima, which are curry squash, kabocha, Hubbard, buttercup, those squash have a slightly longer storage window, quite a bit longer. And often when you take them out of the field, they're not quite ripe. They have to have this after ripening period to get the best flavor. So you actually want to take those out and store them for a month before you start eating them.
So and what would it look like? What would the fruit itself look like?
For Cucurbita maxima, there's a lot of variations.
But so, I mean, in terms of it being, you know, when do I take it out? Is it kind of a little green by the vine, or what do you kind of look for?
Well, it would look ripe. So it would look like the stem had died back and the vines had all died back. So you would harvest them at the end of the season in October when all the plants are essentially dead. But that fruit itself has to continue ripening for a little bit longer. And so that would be one to keep in storage for a month or so and then start eating. The butternuts, so Cucurbita machata, they typically store quite a long time. And a lot of the pumpkin that we buy in cans are actually machata types rather than a true pumpkin.
Yeah.
Like an example, yeah, Waldo is a really good butternut that really store really well.
What is it again?
Waldo, W-A-L-D-O, it's a large butternut that have really excellent yield and taste and store really well. It's from Johnny's Seed, I believe.
Yes, it's from Johnny's. It's one of their new releases that actually started in our trials as a numbered line, and we've had it in our trials for a few years, and that's one of the ones that we would definitely recommend.
Yeah, and storage is really a trade that we are including in the platform seedlings. That is still a prototype, but when it will be launched, you will be able to sort by, let's say, storage and see what are the better storage squash, for example.
And what's a typical length of storage anyway? I mean, it's sort of an average. What's the average squash going to store under good conditions?
Yeah, it'll depend on the species. So the delicatas and acorns are not going to keep too much probably past Thanksgiving. Might be a little into December. The maximas are still typically good around this time, although this year we had more disease issues in storage because they were so wet in the field. And then the butternuts, I've had them store until March sometimes. But there's
amazing.
Yeah, yes. There's variation within them too. So that's why we do the variety rankings and try to see which varieties within each of these species stores the best. But as a general rule, the species do have some differences in storability.
So there's the squash. Jim, did you also ask about potatoes?
Well, yes, but we don't want our potatoes to tiller till we can eat them up, you know, in April or May. And so we bought a refrigerator to keep them totally dark. But, yeah, that's something we don't want tillering as a feature in a potato if we want to store it a long time, right?
Yeah, we also do take storage data on potatoes. We don't have that on the website right now, but we're working on actually getting that up this week. It might not be up by the end of the week, but we're starting the process right now.
And Jim mentioned tillering and people
sprouting.
Sprouting is what he was talking about there. And did you mention any other one, Jim? I forgot.
No, that was great, and I'll check out the website and try to find some Waldo butternut squash.
There you go.
I still have some in my basement and making soup. It's towards the end, but
it's getting toward the end.
In a good year, it would last much longer. But yeah, we had some fusarium issues this year.
Not a squash; it's a tomato. But I did get an email from somebody in December who said, "I ate the last of my garden tomatoes in December." Wow. She's stored them green, brought in the green ones at the end of the season. I usually do that too. They don't taste as good, but they're your own. I had some in November. She had December, so she beat me. All right. Well, tell you what, let's go to Rebecca. By the way, you can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Julie Dawson, Nicole, Angel Bear, our guest today, and Rebecca in Westboro, it's your turn. Hi.
Hello. I'm wondering, I've been taking part in the collaborative with Julie for a while now, and I'm wondering, with the recent weather extremes that we've been having on our farm, it's really been creating our own trialing system where we see varieties stand out in the face of adversity. How do you, or what challenges does the recent weather extremes present for the research that you're doing? And is there a way to let consumers know about what varieties are standing out in these extreme weather conditions? This year we were in drought, but areas immediately to our south were in flood. So it created some challenges.
Yeah, we got 11 inches of rain the day of our field day. So, yes, we've had some weather extremes and people have hail and all kinds of issues. I think what we try to do is test across years to see which ones are reliable in different conditions. And then we were just talking about getting more notes up on our website about, in this really wet year, this is the one that stood out, or in the dry year, this is the one that stood out. So you're absolutely right. Trying to have those varieties that might stand up to particular weather extremes is important. I think also trying to find varieties that can deal with different weather extremes, because you never know which season you're going to get when you plant. So you wouldn't necessarily plant one that does really well in a super wet year but produces nothing in a dry year. You want one that's kind of resilient to the different climate extremes that might get thrown at you. So we trial things over multiple years. We try to note standouts in particularly harsh conditions. And then we also know that in certain years, we will be more able to evaluate certain traits than in others. So certain diseases are more prevalent in a wet year or a dry year. And so those years give us the opportunity to look at disease resistances that we might not have in another year. And so we really try to take advantage of whatever each year throws at us. I think that for any kind of breeding program, climate extremes are a real challenge. And that's one of the things that we talk about a lot with other breeders, is how are we going to breed something that works for hail or that works for 11 inches of rain? And so then it's a really a conversation between what varieties we're developing and what management systems we're developing. And there are a lot of people working on really innovative management on farm. I work with a number of farmers that are trying to reduce tillage, to increase cover cropping, to make their soils more resilient to these extremes, so that we have both a variety that can buffer some of the extremes and a management system that can buffer the extremes. And I think we're really going to have to put all of our tools together to resist some of these climate fluctuations that we seem to be seeing a lot more of.
Yeah, I see a couple illustrations, maybe from a breeder standpoint, and just to remind, UW is this amazing research happening on resiliency, and I think it's Dr. Picasso who worked on resiliency as a trait from a breeder perspective, and I used to be an alfalfa breeder, and we started to do some breeding in terms of to see which variety tend to be more stable over this extreme environment. And one of the ways is also to breed population. So we have different type of variety, and we can dive more in depth later if we have time. But you know, we have a variety can be a population. So you can, when you buy multiple seed, let's say, of an alfalfa of a vegetable, every seed is going to be very similar, but everything is strictly it's different. And so by having a population, and I think Dr. Masaryk bred a pickle cucumber like this, you can face different stress, like higher precipitation, but also drought. And that's a fundamental law of nature, is diversity equal resilience, and we can't forget about that. So as a breeder, we went to the extreme in terms of breeding inbred line, very fixed, and doing hybrids, but population can be a tool to that. And maybe just to do a quick segue into seedlinked, we are integrating, we call data layering or environmental conditions. So for example, you may have heard about a wonderful program called COCORAS. It's a citizen science precipitation network where everybody into precipitation. Well, all this data, we are trying to see how can we integrate this in the platform when all the people who participate in those testing, those data can be paired with environmental. So let's say somebody rate a variety really well under those 11 inch of precipitation, or this 25% more precipitation we had last year in many areas. And we can see which variety then do better in those different environments.
Interesting. Well, we are talking with Julie Dawson today from the University of Wisconsin Department of Horticulture. She leads the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative in Wisconsin. Nicole Angelbear is co-founder and CEO of SeedLink, and great to have them with us. And we certainly, and Rebecca, thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest, Julie Dawson from the University of Wisconsin Department of Horticulture, and Nicholas Angelbear, co-founder and CEO of SeedLink. Lots of callers online, so I think we'll go right back to the phones and to Cindy in Dodgeville next. Cindy, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I see this SeedLink as a fantastic way to connect people that live in various places but regionally have similar interests. And one of my questions, or my particular question, is do you see this in the future potentially expanding for, say, growers who are interested in alternative crops to corn and soybeans, so that they have other folks that they can connect with, say, sunflowers or grain crops or other specialty seeds that, that are not generally available, but with a network like this, there'd be a way to share tips and get some feedback.
Wow. And Cindy, thanks.
Cindy, that's a wonderful question. And right now, SeedLink is in a prototype or proof of concept, so it's not launched yet. And it was easier to test with vegetable with Julie. But the beauty to work with Julie is that she has so much experience in grain as well, corn, wheat. Maybe, Julie, do you want to talk about grain and wheat and how it could be applied to a platform?
Sure. So my background's in organic wheat breeding, and I did that for about 10 years before I came here and started in vegetables. So there are a number of different initiatives with organic wheat, for particularly for bread making quality. And I think that's where we've seen a lot of interest in people knowing which varieties are adapted to the Midwest and very good for artisanal bread making quality, in particular for local markets. There are a few challenges to growing bread wheat in Wisconsin because we have high humidity summers and rain during flowering for the wheat, which can lead to some diseases that are actually dangerous for human consumption of the grain. So the variety choices become even more important, trying to find varieties that are less susceptible to fusarium, which then can result in vomitoxin in the grain. So we have actually a few trials. The challenge with wheat trials is that it requires equipment for small-scale plot management, and so it takes a little bit longer to get things to on-farm trials because you have to bulk up seed to the point where a farmer could plant it. For garden trials or for smaller-scale trials, it might be possible to do that where people are primarily planting and harvesting by hand. We have a number of varieties that we've been trialing for a couple years now in Wisconsin with Lucia Gutierrez, who's the small grains breeder here at UW-Madison, and with farmers, particularly Harold Wilkin down in Illinois. So those varieties are a combination of some lines from public breeding programs that have resistance to fusarium head blight and lines that were developed as part of a participatory breeding project with farmers in the Northeast, and some of them come from some work I did in France with a network of farmers there that was developing wheat for artisanal bread making quality. So we have some really exciting populations that we're hoping will get out in the next few years. We need to do the seed increases, and we're also working with a group of local bakers, Andrew Hutchinson from Madison Sourdough, and a few other bakers to do quality testing with them. So we're hoping to have information on those available soon, and as much as possible, we would be integrating it into something like Seed to Kitchen and Seed Linked so that more people can do trialing. There's just that little challenge of wheat is not usually hand planted and hand harvested, so it takes a bit more work on the part of the gardener to be able to actually evaluate that crop.
And the other crops, I could think of other crops that organic farmers may want to try, hopefully down the road. Same issues as you just described with wheat, I would guess.
Yeah, we have, hemp now coming, and we see the same issue with variety and which variety is going to be more adapted. We have a wonderful project with the Land Institute with perennial wheat and Kernza, and we see many farmers who are testing it. But how to share this information, how to grow it, how does it perform in each environment? And so again, with the platform concept, we are trying to help those different
groups.
Put
that together.
Yeah, and so it's very exciting. There's so many exceptional projects all across the country working with brewer, with baker, with,
It's exciting. Well, let's take another call. Guy in Stoddard, we'll turn to you. Hi, Guy.
Yeah, I wanted to know if you've ever heard of the tomato. It's been developed at a Cornell University. It's pretty new, called Brandywise, W-I-S-E.
Yep.
And it's for triple resistance, and I wanted to know what you thought about it.
So we haven't had it in our trials, but I believe it's been trialed in a project called NOVIC, the Northern Organic Vegetable Improvement Collaborative. And so they have been testing a number of varieties across the northern tier of the U.S., and so that was one of the ones I believe that came out well in those trials. It was bred at Cornell by Martha Mutchler. I think she's the tomato breeder there. And it's a cross between Brandywine, that's an heirloom, and some of the newer varieties that she's developed to have late blight, early blight, and septoria resistance, which are early blight and septoria are really our major challenges here. We get them every year in our field. I'm sure that all of you at home also see.
Everybody knows about it.
Right, yes. So those are our major challenges. There is not real strong disease resistance to septoria and early blight that's like night and day, it gets sick or it doesn't. There's more of this quantitative reduction of disease incidence. And so having those genetics hopefully reduces the amount of disease that you see and extends your season a little bit more before your plant goes down to septoria or early blight. We have had some of the breeding lines from Cornell and from North Carolina those backgrounds in our trials. And in general, we see some reduction in disease, but it's not an extreme reduction. It's not like they don't get sick at all. It's just a longer period of time until they're defoliated.
No. Takes them longer to die.
Yeah, we do have a breeding project where we're trying to combine, much like Martha is, disease resistance and flavor. And that's a collaborative project that includes people all over the country.
Well, you know, the whole thing's a process, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it's a long process.
Yeah, as a breeder, you have to be patient. Like, it can be a 12-year journey, but it's fascinating and it's really rewarding to see your own almost baby come to life.
Yeah, and then you've got, you know, at Cornell, they produce Brandywise. Well, maybe from Brandywise, there's going to be another variety come that's going to do an even better job, and that's kind of the whole process. It's what the professionals go through, but it's also what the gardeners go through as well, because we experiment. Sometimes things work, and sometimes they don't work.
Right.
And that's kind of part of the fun of gardening. Well, our guest today, Julie Dawson, she's an assistant professor in the Department of Horticulture. She leads the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative in Wisconsin. Nico Angelbear is co-founder and CEO of SeedLink. And by the way, we have both of those sites up on our WPR website, so you can go to wpr.org/Larry, and you will find links to them. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my two guests, Julie Dawson, assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. She leads the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative in Wisconsin. With her, Nico Angelbear. He is the CEO and co-founder of SeedLink. So, talking with them about seeds today, do you have a favorite variety you want to tell us about or a question about varieties and seeds? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll take a call from Myron in Montello next. Myron, thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I was going to give you a couple tips that I didn't hear you touch on today. The one is, I think, coolness, dryness, and darkness is the key to keeping things. And when it comes to squash and pumpkins, do not remove that stem or handle. And that also goes, Larry, with the green tomatoes we harvest before that frost. Leave that cap or that blossom on them. And also, the green tomatoes and the squash and the pumpkins, I wash them with a very mild bleach solution, because a lot of spoilage starts from the outside in, from bacteria, and that little bit of bleach in the water seems to purify it. And as far as keeping potatoes, I don't think they have to be refrigerated. I've heard that refrigeration does something with the starch, the sugar in them. Darkness and dryness, I think, is the key. That's about all I got. And my background, like I say, is I'm 82 years old and grew up on a produce farm in Racine County.
Well, Myron, it's great to have you call. And Julie, I think he's pretty much right on.
Yeah, you definitely want to avoid doing anything that might cause an injury to the fruit, whether it's the pumpkin or the tomatoes, because that's a point of entry for some kind of rot bacteria or fungal diseases. So anything that has a scratch or breaking the stem off can give that disease a point of entry. In terms of storage in the fridge, most squash like it slightly warmer than fridge temperatures, but they do like it drier and cool and dark. The potatoes also, if you're going to be eating them, like it slightly warmer. So like a 45 to 50 degree temperature and dark to keep them from sprouting. the darkness is pretty key to keep them from either going green or sprouting because they're light sensitive. What happens when you put them at lower temperatures is that the starch converts to sugars, and so you get a sweetening of the potato, which is not desirable for a lot of applications. You know, a lot of ways you cook potatoes, you don't really want them to be sweet.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Myron, thanks again. Appreciate the call. Cecilia in Manitowoc, we'll go to you next. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call and for this show. I'm calling regarding some notation I'm seeing on seed packets that I haven't seen in the past. They're saying to plant in sterile starting mix without fertilizer. Well, of course, the starting mix I bought has fertilizer in it. Is that a problem?
I don't know how much of a problem it will be. Many commercial growers start in a mix that doesn't have fertilizer, and then when they pot up to a bigger size, then they might have something that has a little more nutrient content. If there is too much fertilizer, it can burn the seedling. And so that's probably what they're asking you to be careful of. I have not seen seed packets with that on it, so I'm not exactly sure what the instructions say, but I would guess that they're cautioning you that you could burn them if you put fertilizer too close to the seed, and that they don't need fertilizer to begin with. That seed is a packet of energy for the developing plant. So for the first little bit of its life, it really doesn't need fertilizer to get started. It only needs that later on.
I agree with you, Julie. And I think oftentimes the potting soil it's a very low amount of fertilizer. And so I think it's really to not try to burn your seedling.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense to me. Cecilia, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Karen emailed to say that she plants Detroit beets every year. It was good beet. Last year, they tasted awful. No sweetness at all. They tasted more like soap. She did leave them in the ground longer than the number of days on the package. But what would cause this kind of off taste?
So that's a good question. I actually talked to Solveig Hansen, who's one of Erwin Goldman's graduate students, and they work on beets. And beets can develop saponins, which are a chemical compound that would make them taste like soap. They are able to generate that compound, but not much is known about the environmental conditions that cause that. But it was probably some environmental trigger that led the plant to produce these saponins. I don't believe it would be due to leaving them in the ground longer. But as I said, there doesn't seem to be much known about what actually triggers the production of those.
And we don't know, Karen emailed but didn't say where she was emailing from, so we don't know if it was a particularly wet area where they got 11 inches of rain like you did or what. So, but Karen, that's something to think about a little bit in terms of, you know, what were the growing conditions like for your beets last year, and maybe that had an impact. Oh, there we go. George in Partyville will give you a chance now. Hi, George.
Hi, guys. I got a couple of questions. The first one has to do with the greenhouse. I have a nice greenhouse. It's about 10 feet wide and about 14 feet long. And I was just wondering, what kind of temperature should I be shooting for at night in the greenhouse?
What do you have in the greenhouse?
I don't have anything yet.
Okay.
Yeah, it depends what you're growing. So something that's an early spring crop, like onions, don't require that high a temperature. They're pretty cold tolerant. If you've got solanaceous or cucurbits in there, you don't want to get below about 50 at night, particularly solanaceous crops. And cucurbits are even more cold sensitive, but usually they're in there a little later. But solanaceous crops really don't grow very well below 50 degrees, so I would say that's a ballpark. I'm certainly not an expert on greenhouse production of all different crops, so you can probably find some information online. Or if you've got specific questions on temperatures, feel free to contact me and I can get you to somebody who knows.
And are you available through your website, the collaborative, Seed to Kitchen Collaborative?
Yes, there's contact information there. And my email directly is Dawson, D-A-W-S-O-N, at Hort, H-O-R-T, dot Wisc, W-I-S-C, dot E-D-U.
All right. And the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative and also Nico's Seedlink company We have links to both of those on WPR.org/Larry, our site as well. So thank you, George, very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have open lines, so we'll get you on pretty quickly here. Susan in Milwaukee emailed to ask if the average homeowner with only a few of each plant, you know, can they participate in these trials?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really, it's really weird. Having all of you as gardeners allow us to have way more data points, and just few plants will give valuable information. So please, if you're interested, feel free to join.
Let's go back through that once more again as to how people sign up or and what's all involved in both your operations.
Yeah, I can start with ours, with Seedlinked and product we have with Julie. Right now we are still looking for more gardener, and you go on the website and fill up your information, and in few weeks we will invite you via your email, so you will receive an email, please join our, let's say, pepper trials, and you will log in, create your account in Seedlinked, and as soon as you accept the request to join the trial, you will automatically get the varieties that are going to show up on your dashboard, and then you're going to receive the seed by mail, or even we will send you seedling ready to transplant, and then with the apps or with your web platform on your desktop, you just send very simple review, like disease, vigor, taste, earliness, from 1 to 5, and also you can enter comments and tell us if you like this variety. And that's really the beauty of the crowdsourcing and the wisdom of the crowd. We really succeed to get pattern and information from having a lot of people.
Yeah, so even if you have a few plants.
Exactly.
Get yourself involved. And
yeah.
I should mention that Seedlinked, the site itself is linked. It's Seedlinked with an ED on the end of it.
That's right. Seedlinkeded.com. And please, you can just type on Google over there.
And Julie?
Yeah, so to participate in the Seed to Kitchen trials, we also have a sign up on our website. So seedtokitchen.horticulture.wisc.edu. You can click on either for farmers if you're a farmer or for gardeners if you're a gardener. If you click on for gardeners, it gives you a little bit of information on what types of characteristics we are looking at and what observations we ask you to collect on the trial varieties. If you sign up for cucumbers, peppers, or carrots, you'll be given the option to also participate in the Seedlinked trials this year. Those are our three pilot crops with Seedlinked. For the other crops, you'll be able to use the Seedlinked platform as a way of recording the data as well. So you can have an option between a paper copy or the online on your phone app. So on the trial request form, it asks for your email address, your contact information. We need your address so that we can mail you seeds. And then there's a option if you are a farmer or a home gardener, or if you belong to the Master Gardeners or some other organization, maybe a community garden that wants to do the trials together, you can choose. And we have different size trials for different scales. So farm trials are bigger than the gardener, the home gardener trials. Because we ask you to do 4 or 5 varieties, you may end up feeling like that's a little too much for a very small garden, but in general, the size of the plots tends to be 2 to 3 plants per variety. For the Seedlinked trials, so cucumbers, carrots, and peppers, there are only 3 varieties, so those are much easier to do in a small-scale home garden situation. And we're kind of moving to, once we do this pilot project with Seedlinked, if it works really well, which from preliminary results, it seems to be very intuitive and easy for gardeners to use, we would probably be moving more of our trials onto that platform just for the ease of use, for the crowdsourcing of data, and also for the immediate sharing of data between users. So you can sign up for any of the crops that we trial. You have the option to pick one or more, and then you indicate your top choice in case we run out of seed. And that's it. We'll be in contact with you by email, and we also will send you the seed, the stakes, the plot map, all of the data sheets, information on how to join the Seedlinked if you want to do that data collection online. And you'll hear from us during the season to ask you what you think of the different varieties.
There we go.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Let's take another call. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff in Superior up next. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I have a general question about planting herbs. Is it okay to plant them with flowers and vegetables, or is it best to keep them separately?
I think it depends on which ones. In general, it's fine to plant them in with other crops, and actually intercropping is a strategy to potentially reduce your disease and pest risk. If you have herbs like mint that can be invasive, that could be something to consider. Perennial herbs are another thing to consider planting a little separately. If you want to till beds for vegetables, you don't want your perennial herb in the middle necessarily. But usually there's not a problem intercropping. One thing that you might think about if you have a slower growing herb is that something like squash might overwhelm them. So you kind of need to think about plant architecture, but I don't think there are any real significant reasons not to do it. It will take some fine tuning to get your system to work really well and not have some plants be space hogs and other ones be kind of shaded out. And there's quite a bit of literature on companion planting that you can find in the garden literature that kind of tell you which herbs or flowers are good for attracting pollinators and for potentially reducing your risks of certain diseases.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much for that call. Somebody else wondered, how do you decide which of those varieties and so forth that you did go over that a little bit way earlier, but talk about that, about the ones that you have so particularly selected.
So our process for deciding which varieties go into the trials is iterative. We have some varieties that are standbys, that are our checks that we have in every year as a point of comparison. So something like Waltham butternut squash. Most people have grown that at some point, know how it behaves, and so it's our check, and it's always in there. And then we have varieties that are recommended by different breeding programs. So we would call a number of breeding programs. Some of it's done by email, some of it's done by phone. But we'll talk to all the breeding programs that we know are breeding for a northern climate, for flavor, for organic production, particularly for diversified, smaller scale systems, so farms and gardens. So we'll talk to the breeders at Johnny's and High Mowing and a few other companies, a lot of smaller scale companies, and then at some universities. And we will solicit entries from them based on what they think would do well in our climate and what they would like information on. We also have surveyed farmers about different varieties that they're growing, and we have meetings each winter to make sure that we're responding to farmer priorities for the types of traits or for the things that they're having trouble finding. For example, there was a carrot called Nelson that was being dropped that a lot of people were relying on, so we then tried to bring in some carrot varieties that might be a potential replacement for that variety and test them out next to that one to see how did the flavor compare, how did the production compare. So it really is a process of talking to breeders and talking to farmers about what they need, and then we work with the chefs as well to see what characteristics they would like in varieties. And often chefs set some of the food trends, and they've been big players in the growth of the local food movement. And so they'll often have ideas about what's coming that we can start testing so that then we'll know what grows well in Wisconsin and people can eventually get those crops at the farmer's market, maybe after trying them at a restaurant or something like that. So it's kind of messy at times, but we really try to get input from everybody on which varieties they would like to see in the trials.
And yeah, especially new variety, and like you mentioned, Julie, having a check is very rule number one in breeding program. We really want to compare to something we know to see if we made progress. Choosing new variety, it's been from your survey, Julie, you mentioned that having adoption of new varieties has been something challenging for farmers because they don't have information, they don't want to take the risk to test
sure.
a new variety. It's a huge risk. As a farmer, you really have 40 shots during
yeah.
your life to test. And so having those new variety and all this data that can be interactive for everyone is a really plus for those new variety.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. John in Mayville, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Yes.
I'm curious about if any of your programs use a method of planting another seed with the main crop. What I'm talking about is the symbiosis that can take place where after the main crop grows, the other seed takes over and actually supplies a compost type of relationship to keep the soil more friable and increase its friability, basically.
Yeah, that's a fascinating concept. And when I was, a few years ago, when I was a breeder for Pioneer, we were testing companion cropping with different vetch and clover with brassica, and that was we were evaluating many different varieties that were interacting with those species in terms of vigor, in terms of size, in terms of growing degree day and dynamic of growth to see the interaction and how much nitrogen the companion cropping is bringing to the crop. And so as breeder, more and more in this sustainable direction from larger company to smaller, we are working in breeding into those companion cropping. And we see really fascinating interaction. We see varieties that do much better with different companion cropping and even with different variety of companion cropping. So it's just a fascinating and complex world out there.
It's really interesting, and I think there's a lot more going on now than there used to be. For our variety trials, the only one we do that with is our winter wheat trial. We underseed that, frost seed it with clover, and so after the wheat comes off, then we have a clover stand. For everything else, we rotate into cover crop as quickly as possible after harvest, so we'll plant a cover crop right back into where that trial was. I am working a little bit on some research that's looking at options for cover cropping in within vegetable systems, so as you're growing the vegetables, and for reducing tillage with Ruth Genger here at UW-Madison and Claire Strader with Dane County Extension. And there we are doing on-farm trials with a number of organic vegetable growers to try to kind of optimize how we could combine cover crops or living mulches with vegetable production in a way that doesn't compete too much with vegetable crops, but has that benefit of maintaining soil cover and adding both nitrogen and organic matter to the soil after the vegetable comes off.
You know, here, as we are getting closer to the end of the show, I wanted to repeat that there are these trials that you've got that the home gardeners can get involved in with different, you'll send them the seeds and all the information if they sign up, as I understand it.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And really, just to remind that together we are stronger and collaborating together and having more and more people, the more data we have, the more well-adapted local variety we can have. And so thanks so much for listening.
Yeah, and so if you can go to either one of the websites for information. And again, it's seedlinked.com, L-I-N-K-E-D, so get the E-D in there, .com. Or seedkitchen.horticulture.wisc.edu, or if you put in UW Seed Kitchen.
Seed to Kitchen, yep.
Seed to Kitchen, it's going to pop up. Quickly, is there a squash that's resistant to squash bugs?
We would love it if there was.
There isn't. Kathy, I'm sorry, there isn't one. Kathy had that question. Well, it's great to have our two guests with us. Take a look at their websites and, hey, sign up. It'd be a lot of fun. It doesn't matter if you've got just a few plants. Just a few plants can make a big difference when we get a lot of people with just a few plants entering their data. So, Julie Dawson and Nicholas Angel Bear, our guests. And thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.